This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. In segment one, we're going to do a show that's new to Night Transmissions. White Hall, 1212. You wouldn't believe how many times I said White House, 1212. Fortunately, I can edit all that out. I know. Some of you are saying, this thing's edited. Yeah, believe it or not, this thing's edited. White Hall 1212 was the first network effort to capitalize on Scotland Yard's having recently opened up a lot of their files. This was a thoroughly American production, written and directed by Willis Cooper. But other than Cooper, the production attempted to ring authentic as a completely British undertaking. All the voice talent was British. The program started on NBC, but NBC was not alone. By the time White House 1212 was well underway, the Orson Welles narrated Black Museum began airing, as well as The Secrets of Scotland Yard. The three shows are so similar that many of the same cases are featured on all three shows. I'd better shut up now. I've been talking too long. I'm going to run out of time. I am running out of time. This episode is from November the 18th of 1951 and is called The Blitz Murder Case.
New Scotland Yard, the London headquarters of the Metropolitan Police, is situate near the embankment on Whitehall, hard by 10 Downing Street and almost in the shadow of Big Ben. Here also is the headquarters of the CID, the Criminal Investigation Department, the body of men whose exploits for more than 100 years have made the name Scotland Yard synonymous with the brilliant detection of crime and unrelenting pursuit of the criminal, and the presentation of the painstakingly acquired evidence that assures his eventual punishment. On the lower ground floor of New Scotland Yard is the famous Black Museum, where whose present custodian is Chief Superintendent James Davidson, a Scotland Yard veteran. Behind this door...
Good afternoon. This Black Museum of ours is rather unique. Everything in it was at one time connected with the successful solution of a crime, or was closely involved in the crime itself. We possess an imposing collection of lethal weapons here, each carefully docketed to indicate its origin. Here are half-empty bottles of almost every poison known to man, together with a statement of particulars concerning its use. Here are the bloodstained garments on which the solution of a crime of violence depended. Among the Black Museum's relics are disguises used by famous criminals, death masks of notorious men and women whose ends Scotland Yard encompassed, and a great many other more gruesome mementos of man's inhumanity to man. Among the exhibits are others seemingly incongruous objects that in their time served well in the undoing of desperate criminals. Such an exhibit is this one, the fragments of a set of teacups. This collection of shards was the first step in the solution of a frightful crime which occurred during the Blitz of July 1940.
Yes, sir?
Would you please bring me file number 302 MR651, Constable?
302 MR651, sir? Yes, sir. One, sir.
In July 1940, the Battle of Britain was at its height. The Luftwaffe hits us at all hours, and from advanced defense fields of the RAF, the weary Spitfires rose day and night to do battle. Thousands of British people died in Britain as a result of enemy action. But in the midst of the very present war, murder went on as usual. Chief Superintendent Peter Carruth received a telephone call at Scotland Yard on the morning of the 3rd of July, a Wednesday.
1302 MR651, sir.
Thank you. The call was from Chief Constable at Matfield, a Kentish village near Tunbridge. The chief constable reported the finding of the bodies of three women shot to death and requested the assistance of the CID. The services of Scotland Yard are available to the provincial police at all times if requested, the Home Office assuming all expenses if the request is made within 24 hours of the discovery of the crime, at their own expense if we're called in after that. Chief Superintendent Carruth was gratified that the request came at the very beginning of the case, and he drove to Matfield at once with a medical examiner from the Home Office and Detective Sergeant Small, also Scotland Yard. They were met at the scene of the crime by Matfield Chief Constable Thomas Bennett.
It's good of you to come so quickly, all of you. It's all quite beyond us here, sir. What with the blitz and all?
I'm sure. I had a bad time.
Having it, sir.
Yes, I've no doubt.
No doubt, Mr. Bennett.
Spitfires. Jerry must be up again.
Well, here's what happened. In the house, there's Miss Evans, the servant.
Is she dead?
2 holes in her head. Place all ransacked. All tore up.
Where are the others?
Mrs. Ames and her daughter Jessica's lying down there in the orchard. Also shot.
Yes, I see.
Where do you want to start, sir?
A house, I think, first.
Yes.
Come in then, sir. Gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They've lived here in Matfield a long time, have they, Benner?
Miss Evans, the servant, has always lived here. Mrs. Ames and her daughter moved here a year ago.
Mrs. Ames, a widow?
No. Estranged from her husband, though they're quite friendly. He lives at Piddington.
Oh, yes, I know. I've been there.
Owns a farm.
Does he know about it?
My station sergeant telephoned him this morning, sir. He was in London, but he'll be home this evening. Shall I go first, sir? She's lying right by the door, and you might trip over her.
By all means.
You might try this.
These are the gentlemen from Scotland Yard, Constable.
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Miss Margaret Evans, sir. Age 61. Seventh. Living in.
Ah. See what you can find out, Bernard.
Right, you are.
Small, get started looking for fingerprints.
Yes, sir.
Place has really been ransacked, hasn't it? What's missing?
Haven't checked yet, sir. Haven't touched anything.
Good.
Well, not much chance of finding out if anything is gone, though. Everybody that lived here is dead.
I'd like to see the others.
Right, sir. If you'll come with me.
What's that over there? Yeah. Tea things?
Yes, sir. Looks as if she dropped the tray when she saw the murderer.
Have a look at them, too, Small.
All right, sir.
Down this part, sir. The orchard, that's where they are.
Mrs. Ames?
And her daughter, Jessica.
They have many visitors?
Very few, sir. And the place is back from the road, isn't a bit by the roses. Hard to tell they do have. Here she is.
This is the daughter, I suppose.
Right, sir. Her mother's over there, off the path.
Daughter was running away toward the house. Mother was facing the other way. Shot in the back, too.
Aye.
Found anything here in the grass? Cartridge cases, anything?
No, sir. We did find this glove, though, sir. Sorry, I had it in my pocket. Almost forgot it.
Woman's glove. Size 6, I'd say. Hogskin. Shop sells thousands a week. Left hand. Whose is it?
Isn't Mrs. Ames, sir, too small? Or Miss Jessica's either. Too large, I'd say, wouldn't you?
Yes, I think so.
Maybe the murderer, sir.
We'll see. All you found?
All so far, sir.
Where was the glove?
Oh, over there, sir. I marked the spot with those two sticks.
Alongside the mother's body?
Yes, sir.
Well, as soon as Bernard's examined the bodies, I think you'd better have all this grass scythed down and see if you can find anything else. Cartridge case or anything.
Right, sir.
Shall we walk back to the house?
Yes, sir. Good hunting, lad.
Beg your pardon?
Fighter chap up there.
Oh.
I hope he shoots some Jerry's bloody ears off.
He probably will.
Got a son in the raft. Flight sergeant of the Coastal Command.
Good man.
19 years old. When I was 19, I was a farm man for good old Uncle Tom Cobbley. What if they found anything yet in there, sir?
We'll see. Oh, here's Bernard. Anything yet?
Well, I want to see the other bodies first. Discovered a little so far. Where are the,
Down the path back there, sir. We've touched nothing.
Except this glove.
Oh, is this one of theirs?
Wrong size.
All right. You can remove the bodies as soon as I finish, Chief Constable.
Yes, sir. I'll have the van here at once. See to it, please.
Yes, sir. What are you doing, Small?
I'm trying to fit these cups together, sir.
Well, what about fingerprints? I wanted you to...
I found a good many, sir. They all checked with hers.
Well, how did you know they were hers?
Oh, I took hers. I wish live people's were as easy to take.
No others?
Well, I'm not sure yet, sir. As soon as I get the others down there, I'll make a very thorough check. These cups and saucers.
She dropped them when she saw the murderer, probably.
Oh, quite. But why should there be four cups, sir?
Four? One for the mother, one for the daughter, one for the maid, for her.
Miss Evans was more a companion than a servant, sir. Here in that field, we...
Yes. And one for the murderer.
Why, then, must have known the murderer.
People don't usually offer a cup of tea to a perfect stranger.
You could make up a list of their friends, Chief Constable.
They
and
very few friends, sir. Kind of standoffish like they was, and the parson, the grocer, housemistress, not any real close friend, so to speak.
Make up a list and check where they all were yesterday.
Yes, sir.
What about this estranged husband of Mrs. Ames? Would he have a motive?
Oh, I don't think so, sir. He used to come and visit her, I know, but...
Oh, he did, eh? And he's in London now, you said?
I went down yesterday morning, they said, sir.
Where does he live, do you say?
Piddington, sir, near Oxford.
You take over, Sergeant Small, you and Mr. Bernard. I'll call you from Piddington.
Piddington, sir? Do you think...
I think I'd like to know whether our friendly ex-husband was really in London yesterday or elsewhere.
At Piddington, that afternoon, 70 miles away from that field, Jem Davies, the man of all work, explained to Chief Superintendent Carruth that John Ames had not yet returned from London. Miss Viola Masterson, the manager of the Ames farm, however, was at home, recovering from an accident. Carruth spoke to her in her sitting room. Her left arm was in bandages, and she was obviously in slight pain. Carruth sympathized with her.
I am so sorry to disturb you, Miss Masterson.
It's quite all right. I'll be up and about in a day, sir. It pains a little, though, now.
I suppose you've heard about the former Mrs. Ames and her daughter.
I'm so dreadfully sorry. I knew them slightly, you know.
Oh, did you?
I'd have gone over to Natfield if I hadn't been so stupid as to fall off my bicycle and injure my arm. I'm afraid I'm not a very good cyclist. Oh, do you have any clues as to the...
Murderer? Very few at the moment. Very few, I'm afraid.
Oh, what a pity.
Mr. Ames went to London yesterday,
Yes. He was probably in London while his former wife and daughter were murdered. He often stops in to see them on his way. If he'd stopped there yesterday, he might have prevented it.
Yes. I suppose he can account for his movements yesterday.
I'm quite sure he can, Superintendent. I expect him at any moment.
You were here at the farm all day?
I rode about the farm all day on my bicycle until I had the accident.
Ah.
I'm sure Jemmy Davis can confirm that. And the bicycle is still where I left it, where I fell off. Unless Jemmy's brought it back.
I see. By the way, have you ever seen this glove before?
Let me see it. No, I'm afraid not. Did it belong to...
We're not quite sure.
Well, it's not mine. Much too big for me, I'm sure, Superintendent.
You've never seen it before?
Never.
Thank you, Miss Masterson.
Is that all you wanted? Aren't you going to wait for Mr. Ames?
Oh, I don't like to disturb you, Miss Masterson. I'll wait out there with Jemmy. It is Jemmy, isn't it?
By all means, talk to Jemmy. I'm sure he'll confirm everything I've said.
Good day, Miss Masterson.
You know where to find Jemmy.
He was sitting alongside the stable door cleaning a shotgun when I last saw him.
Jemmy Davis was a simple-minded man. He didn't realize that he was talking much too freely to the friendly Scotland Yard man.
Well, it'd be a terrible thing, I expect, but I don't shed no tears for him. I didn't like her, nor her daughter, neither.
Hated them?
It'd be none of my business, sir. But now, Mr. Ames, he'd be a real fine man. And she... She treated him awful bad.
How?
Dog in the manger. Kicks him out, she does. And then when he finally meets a woman he loves, and that woman loving him, she won't give him no divorce.
You seem to know a lot about Miss Raine's affairs, Jemmy.
Him and me, we be just like that. I'd do anything for that man. Or two, for that matter.
Who?
Miss Masterson. There. Well, that's pretty clean, ain't it?
Let's see. Seeing as I'd ever want a gun to be.
Had it for years. Old-fashioned, like me. but she'd be a good shotgun. He uses it all the time for rabbits.
Mr. Ames?
Well, buys his own shells, too. Miss Masterson, she's scared of it. Tried to teach her how to shoot it. But she was scared. Hey, you couldn't kill a person with this here gun, I says to her. Not unless you got up real close. Funny thing, though. She shot a rabbit with it yesterday. You know, it made her so sick at her stomach when she shot the poor little fella. Never again, she says to me.
Did you see the rabbit, Jemmy?
Well, what were left of it? She were too close. Well, not worth bringing back to cook. You know, I think that's why she fell off her bicycle thinking about it.
Where did she fall?
Well, it was in the meadow yonder. Wheel slipped on the grass.
Jemmy, did you ever see this glove before?
Huh? No, sir. Oh, can't say as how I have.
Sure?
No, sir. Whose is it?
I found it.
Well, finders keepers.
That's what they say. So you don't think Mr. Ames and Miss Masterson will be upset by Mrs. Ames' death?
Lord bless you, no, sir. Now they can get married. Well, that dog in the manger wife of his. Oh, he must have been the last one to see her alive.
Oh? How's that?
When he stopped to see her on the way to London yesterday. Why, I thought you was going to wait for him to come back, sir.
Chief Superintendent Carew hurried to the local police station, where he put through a trunk telephone call to Matfield. Detective Sergeant Small, the Scotland Yard man, answered the telephone at the murder house.
Small here.
Small, I want you to check at once on something.
Yes, sir.
I want you to make the most diligent inquiries. Get that chief constable there to inquire of every person in Matfield, if necessary, at once, to discover if this man Ames was seen in Matfield yesterday. You got that?
He was seen, sir.
He was?
The postman, sir. We've been making inquiries all over the village of Mrs. Ames' known friends, and we've come across several curious things, sir.
Well?
Well, the postman observed Mr. Ames walking toward this house yesterday afternoon.
He's sure?
He positively identified him, sir. Known him for years. Spoke to him, called him by name, and Ames replied.
What else?
He was carrying a shotgun, sir.
Oh. I discovered here that he intended to visit them, but the gun...
Well, looks as if he's our man, doesn't it?
What else did you discover?
Well, the bicycle belonging to Mrs. Ames is missing.
Oh?
And the porter at the railway station reports a strange woman carrying a parcel arrived in town yesterday, but so far we have been unable to trace her. Now, the local police have picked up a deserter from an army camp near here. He's being questioned now. Then a lorry driver for the gas company at Oxford reports picking up a woman on the highway near here yesterday afternoon. She was wearing one glove.
Oh?
Now, he thinks her bare hand was scratched and bleeding.
Yes?
She explained she'd fallen off her bicycle and was trying to catch a train. He took her to the railway station. And then... Well, what did you say, sir?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, I was speaking to Dr. Bernard, sir. I'll put him on. He wants to speak to you. Thank you. You heard, Ruth?
Yes, Bernard.
I've discovered why you didn't find any spent cartridges, Superintendent.
Yes?
The women were killed with a shotgun, probably a .410 shotgun.
Yes, yes, sir.
The murderer had to pick the discharged shell out of the breech of the gun by hand.
Yes, but...
Probably carried them away and disposed of them elsewhere.
Did you recover any of the shot from the bodies?
Yes, quite small pellets, birdshot.
Mark it in evidence and hold it for me. I think those little lead pellets are going to hang someone, Bernard.
Back at the Piddington farm, Chief Inspector Carew found that Ames had returned in his absence. Jamie, the garrulous man of all work, was just leaving. He was going to fetch Miss Masterson's abandoned bicycle, he said.
Why is he going out to fetch Miss Masterson's bicycle, sir?
Look here, Jamie. Would you like a half a crown?
What for?
That rabbit Miss Masterson shot. Is it near where she left the bicycle?
Oh, a fair long or two, sir.
Fetch it back, boy.
What for, sir? It ain't fit to eat. She were too close.
Oh. I'd have fancied to see how that gun of yours works, Jim.
Oh, that old gun of mine, she be a very good gun, sir.
Show me. Here.
Well.
Good man. Now, is Mr. Ames in the house?
Aye, sir. Now, I'll fetch the rabbit and show you. But the poor thing will be all full of birdshot, sir.
That'll be all right, Jimmy. I'm very interested in birdshot. I'm Chief Superintendent Caruth of Scotland Yard. You're John Ames, hmm?
Yes. Are you the gentleman who was here this afternoon?
Yes. May I come in?
Do. You've come about the murder of my wife and daughter?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Caruth, you said?
Yes.
I cannot pretend any great grief, although I'm shocked at the tragedy.
May I sit down? I spoke to Miss Masterson, your manager, this afternoon.
She said you were here.
Perhaps if Miss Masterson is strong enough...
Here I am.
Oh, sit down, my dear. Please, sit down.
Don't hurt my hand, John. I'm all right. Well, sir?
Am I correct in assuming that with the death of Mr. Ames' strange wife, you and he...
We can be married, yes.
Mr. Ames?
That is true. My wife has consistently refused to give me a divorce. Although we were on fairly good terms.
She and I weren't. I'm glad she's dead.
Violet,
and
yes.
That horrid daughter of hers, too. Now we're rid of them once and for all.
Violet.
Do you share Miss Masterson's views, Mr. Ames?
I'm afraid...
Well, perhaps he's not as ferocious as I am, but he shares my views all right. Don't you, John?
Yes.
And what were you doing with a shotgun on the way to our home yesterday, Mr. Ames?
John, you didn't. You didn't.
Mr. Ames.
You didn't tell me. Oh, John. John, now you spoiled everything.
Your wife and your daughter were murdered with a shotgun, Mr. Ames.
I didn't do it.
He didn't, I say.
What gauge is your shotgun, Mr. Ames?
This is absurd, Mr.
It's of course it's
why
absurd.
Why do you think it's absurd?
My dear sir, my gun, which incidentally is an American-made Remington over and under 12 gauge, has been broken for 4 weeks.
You see?
Broken?
The sear spring is broken. It's quite impossible to fire the gun. You can examine the gun at your leisure at Henny McGovern's The Gunsmiths on High Holborn in London, where I took it yesterday.
We'll check that. Why did you visit your wife yesterday, carrying your broken gun?
I dropped off in Matfield on my way to London to have the gun repaired. I begged her again to give me a divorce.
She refused?
She refused again.
For the last time. And we're going to be married now at last. Don't expect us to weep for her. Whoever killed her should be given a medal.
Violet.
Oh, stop it. You're just as glad as I am. Aren't you?
Excuse me. The telephone.
Yes? Yes, he's here. One moment. It's for you, Mr. Caruth.
Thank you. Chief Superintendent Caruth, him.
Small here, sir. We found Mrs. Ames' missing bicycle.
Oh.
Yes, sir. Discovered in a ditch close to the place where the lorry driver picked up the woman with one glove.
Oh, good.
And there are numerous fingerprints on the handlebar, sir, but of the right hand only.
Most interesting.
And the strange woman whom the railway reporter observed was carrying a parcel, you remember?
Yes, of course.
Well, it was a long parcel about the length of a gun, he says, wrapped in brown paper.
I see. Have you taken the things you spoke about?
Things, sir?
Yes.
Oh, the fingerprints on the bicycle?
Yes, quite.
Yes, sir, I've taken them.
How soon could I see them and the people you spoke of?
Up there, sir?
Yes.
Well, there's enough train that we can have stop at Pittington leaving here in half an hour, sir.
I think you'd better come then if you can find the others you mentioned. I'll meet you at the Pittington station.
Right, sir.
Goodbye. I'm very sorry.
Could I ask? You have uncovered some other evidence, sir?
You're not going to arrest John, then? He won't be charged with Murder?
I think I can almost assure you that you will not be charged with murder, Mr. Ames. I'm sorry, I must go and meet my colleagues. This is quite important.
Will you be coming back?
I probably shall. I shall want to be able to assure Mr. Ames that he will not be held.
Oh, John.
Is the Scotland Yard man still here, Mr. Ames?
Why, I'm here, Jemmy.
Well, I fetch you the dead rabbit, sir, with your half-crown's worth of birdshot.
They met him at the railway station 2 hours later. Detective Sergeant Small, Chief Constable Bennett, the lorry driver who had picked up the woman with the bloody hand and the one glove, and the railway porter who had observed the woman carrying the brown paper parcel the size of a gun. Leaving Chief Constable Bennett at the station to make a telephone call, the party proceeded to the Ames Farm.
Good evening, Mr. Carew.
May we come in, please?
Why, this is quite a delegation.
May we come in, please?
I suppose. Do come in, although...
Thank you. Where's Miss Masterson?
Viola?
Yes, dear? Why, what...
Miss Masterson, do you recognize any of these people?
Why, no, of course not.
Patterson, do you recognize this woman?
Hey. She's the lady in blue slacks I picked up my lorry on the road in Matfield yesterday. The lady that said she fell off her bike. Her hand was all bloody and she had one glove on.
Like this one?
Yes, sir. Exactly like that.
O'Connor.
Yes, sir?
Have you ever seen this lady before?
I've seen her yesterday, sir. Getting off the 1206 train that passes through Piddington before it gets to Batfield. She was wearing blue slacks and carried a brown paper parcel about the size of a gun, sir.
Now, look here. What's the meaning of all this?
Come in. Well, Bennett.
Just like you thought, sir. I telephoned the doctor who treated Miss Masterson, and he informs me that he treated her left hand for multiple lacerations, removing particles of road gravel and stains of tarvia from the palm. Miss Masterson... There is no gravel or tarvia at the meadow.
Thank you. Mr. Ames, I'm extremely sorry for you.
John, now we won't get married.
Viola Masterson, John. I arrest you on the charge of willful murder.
I wanted to get married and she stood in our
way. And I must warn you that anything you say will be taken down and may be used in evidence against you.
John, what about Darcy?
The evidence adduced by Chief Superintendent Carruth, the identifications by the lorry driver and the railway porter, the shotgun pellets which proved identical with those Miss Masterson had fired into the unfortunate rabbit, the glove which was identified as hers by the store which had sold it to her, the gravel from the road in her wounded hand, and the motive, which was all too plain, proved sufficient evidence to convict Viola Masterson of the murders of Mrs. Ames and her daughter, and of the servant, Margaret Evans, who provided the first cue, the fourth cup. Miss Masterson had determined to murder the servant to eliminate the only witness to the murder of the others. In a trial marked with frequent air raid alarms caused by an enemy whose depredations could not prevent murder from going on as usual, she was found criminally insane and is now imprisoned in the asylum, Broadmoor. John Ames was tried as an accomplice, but acquitted. He joined the 1st Battalion of the Baps and was reported missing in action in the Italian campaign.
You've just heard the first case in the series Whitehall 1212, drawn from the official files of Scotland Yard by permission of Commissioner Sir Harold Scott. All names were changed in this story for obvious reasons, but everything else is true. It occurred. Whitehall 1212 is written and directed for radio by Willis Cooper.
I'd like to check out famous laundromats of the world by Audrey Schnorbart.
Sir, excuse me, but isn't that ball and chain you're wearing just like the ones they use in the Kellogg Special K commercial?
This ball and chain?
Yes, that one. How are you going to get rid of it?
Well, you know, lots of good exercises, and by eating smart at every meal, starting with the Special K breakfast.
Don't you have to watch your calories?
Yes, and the Special K breakfast is less than 240 calories.
Less than 240 calories?
Now, when I said that NBC was the first network to present crimes from Scotland Yard, I didn't mean to imply that it was the first radio show to do so. The Secrets of Scotland Yard was actually the first, but it wasn't a network program. In fact, it was first broadcast in 1950 from a pirate radio station in southeastern Africa, Mozambique to be exact. This program was created and syndicated by Harry Allen Towers, who in 1951 and 1953 would produce the much better known The Black Museum, which also at first aired out of another private radio station, Radio Luxembourg. Actually, what made Whitehall 1212 stand out from these other two is the presence of the actual superintendent of the museum, the Black Museum, that is, Chief Superintendent John Davidson. He was the host and would point out a museum relic and would begin to tell the case. And, you know, he wasn't as dramatic as Orson Welles over at the Black Museum, or Clive Brook, even, over at the Secrets of Scotland Yard. But he didn't have to pretend to know what he was talking about. I mean, he was actually the superintendent. They also had a first-rate researcher, Percy Hoskins, who was the chief crime reporter for the London Daily Telegraph. In fact, he was the newspaper man who had initially reported on some of the crimes being dramatized. Like Joe Friday in Dragnet, Cooper tried to stick to the facts. Oh, there were blood and guts, but it was the cold variety, and only alluded to as the detective stepped over the bodies in search of clues. The actual crimes were not enacted. This is another way in which this show is different from The Secrets of Scotland Yard and The Black Museum. It's more of a police procedural. Whitehall 1212 was decidedly more oriented towards mystery rather than horror, a more intellectual approach to crime, which, of course, is the opposite of the Inner Sanctum. And a show like Death as an Artist from December the 3rd of 1945.
Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup present Inner Sanctum Mysteries, starring Lee Bowman. Good evening, friends. This is your host, Raymond. Welcome to the Inner Sanctum. Come in, won't you? What are you staring at? The walls. Well, you know that old saying about walls having ears. Well, these walls have eyes and a nice assortment of fingers and hands. One of them has a heart, but you can't beat that. Our story tonight is about one of the fine arts, murder. It's called Death is an Artist, an original tale by Frederick Matho. And our star is from Hollywood, Lee Bowman. Soon to appear with Rita Hayworth in the Columbia Technicolor picture tonight and every night. So, curdle close to the fire and turn the lights down real low. By the way, if you have a little spook or two in your home, looking behind your shower curtains before turning on the water is the courteous thing to do. Otherwise, you might be dampening your spirit. Now let's get on with our story. I'm Stevie, a reporter. I'm what's called a police reporter because I hang around police stations for my stories. But tonight, I'm the best reporter in the world because I've got that kind of a story that's only given to one writer in 1,000, once in a lifetime. This story begins with the end of a man's life. Yesterday, an old man living alone with his 5 cats on an abandoned barge under the Brooklyn Bridge cut off the heads of 4 of his cats, then expertly slit his own throat from ear to ear. At 6 o'clock on the morning we got the flash about this old man, I was playing cribbage with Mike, my police pal, at the station house squad room. Burke, the desk captain, was snoring his head off. Okay, Mike, there it is. Go, 121 points. That last run made it.
You're the luckiest jerk, Stevie.
We're both lucky. Not a call the whole night.
Sure hate to drive out to anything in this blizzard. Police, 84th Precinct, Brooklyn. What? Yeah. Wait, say that slower. You haven't seen him in a week. His cats ain't around. Oh, but lady... Blood in the snow. Well, that's different, sure. Yeah, okay, thanks.
What's up, Captain?
Some dame passes an old barge down the foot of the bridge on her way to work every day. She says an old bum lives there with his cats.
Don't tell me I gotta rescue a cat now.
No, this coot talks to her real polite every morning. But she ain't seen him in a week. Today she goes to look close-like and finds blood in the snow near the door. So
we go see. Probably went south for the winter.
Coming along, Stevie?
Yeah, but I don't like it. Burke mentioned cats, and I hate cats. And I hate people who keep cats.
Well, this is it, I guess. Come on, Stevie.
Hey, look, Mike. There's a snowman.
So what? Haven't you ever seen a snowman?
Yeah, but look. That's not an ordinary snowman. It's a beautifully sculptured head of a woman. Made out of snow.
Come on, it's cold. Let's get inside the scow here. Open up inside.
There is blood out here, Mike. Look. See? Here's where the woman's footprints stop.
Okay, Sherlock. Help me bust this door.
Oh, what's the matter with you?
Look on the floor.
Holy mackerel. 4 cats with their heads cut off. And another one. Alive.
Hey, where are you going?
I told you I can't stand them dead or alive. One of them clawed me when I was a kid.
Stevie, get a load of this over here on the bed. He did a good job. From ear to ear.
He had done a good job. He was naked to the waist and his hairy torso was bathed in blood. His head lay to one side and was nearly severed at the throat. His mouth, a strangely sensitive mouth, hung foolishly open in the middle of a matted mass of beard. But it was his eyes that stirred something inside me. They were coal black agates that smoldered with defiance, even in death. They seemed to carry a message only I was meant to see. I turned away and stumbled over a small wooden box. It contained clay fragments. An impulse seized me, and I carried the box outside.
What do you want that box of trash for?
I'm not sure. I just felt I ought to take it along. Mind?
Just junk. These bums collect the screwiest stuff. Come on, I'll drop you off at your paper. You'll get a news beat on this anyhow.
Okay, Mike. Thanks. I'll call you later to see if you identify the old bird.
All right, Stevie. Hey, here's that box of junk. You want it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks, Mike. I wrote the item. All we could learn was that he was Ivan. No fingerprints on record, no relatives, just Ivan. So he stayed just Ivan to 250,000 readers and to the police.
But to me, he was a man who had not yet died. I poked through the rubble of clay in the box, and I was about to throw the whole mess out when a time-blackened metal tag caught my eye. It was the kind of tag used to mark paintings or statues. It read, Agatha, January 2nd, 1924. 20 years ago, today. And below that was a name, Ivan Thorne. The name jangled a bell in my memory. It frightened me. It fascinated me. I rummaged in the box some more. A hunch grew to certainty. Ivan Thorne had been a sculptor. Here was a fragment of clay, a nose. Here, part of a chin. Here, an ear, a woman's ear. And the snow image of a woman's head came to mind. Why did Ivan Thorne, a sculptor of obvious talent, do a head of a woman named Agatha in clay, then on the same date, 20 years later, as a bum, reproduce it in snow, and slit his throat? I found the answer in the yellowed clippings of the newsroom morgue. The story of Ivan Thorne was filed under Murders Unsolved. After I'd read the story, I marched into GC's office.
Hey, what's up, Stevie? They study the Brooklyn Bridge again?
No. You read the item on the old guy I found with his throat cut?
Sure. Cut off his cat's heads, then his own. Unidentified. Good item.
I know who he is. Was.
Yeah? Story?
Story. You got time to listen?
Shoot.
Well, this begins in a sculptor's studio off Washington Square on a stormy night long ago. Ivan Thorne and Agatha, his wife, were having words.
Meow.
For the last time, Agatha.
Meow.
Are you really going through with this divorce foolishness?
For the last time, yes. I'm tired of living from hand to mouth. I'm tired of your stupid statues. I'm tired of your stupid cats. I'm tired of you.
All right. I'll give you the divorce. You can marry Greg Stevens. He'll give you everything you want. But Horace stays with me. I want custody of the boy.
The court will decide that.
Agatha, I've been working on that head of you for a year. It's good. I think the museum...
Oh, that thing? It doesn't even come close to looking like me.
Of course that head isn't you. It's what I remember you as when I first met you.
Ivan, let go of me. You're hurting me.
All right. I'll let go of you. But I'm going to finish that head, Agatha. And you're going to help me.
I will not.
You'll get your divorce. Only if you agree in writing to pose me one day each month for 6 months. I must finish it.
6 months, And what about Horace?
He's away at school all the time. We'll let the court decide a decent arrangement.
All right, Ivan, I'll do that. Give me that pen. Here. I, Agatha Thorne, agree to pose for a sculptured head by Ivan Thorne on the first day of each month for 6 months. Signed, Agatha Thorne. There you are.
Now, get out. Get out before I break your neck. I'll see her again. 6 more times. That's all I need. 6 more times.
Sounds to me like this Ivan guy is working up a neat little catastrophe.
Mr. Raymond.
Yes, Mary.
I got to thinking about that snowman they found. Did you ever make a snowman?
Oh, sure, and I cut off his head for a souvenir. Kept it in the icebox over the summer.
And you're teasing me, Mr. Raymond. But you know, when I was a child, we used to spend all afternoon making a snowman. And then we'd go in the house for supper with our cheeks red as a frost apple and with a real country appetite. The house was so warm and cozy. Yes, and filled with all the exciting smells of good cooking. You know how children are. They play in the snow and then come in ready to eat you out of house and home. And I've got a grand suggestion for these winter night suppers. Lipton's noodle soup mix. It's such a heartening dish. Thrifty, too. Costs a lot less than canned soups. Yes, Lipton's noodle soup just seems to belong to folks young and old who've got a healthy appetite and a yen for homemade, chickeny-tasting soup.
Mary.
Yes, Mr. Raymond?
Mr. Bowman is waiting to resume his part of the young police reporter, Stevie. That's right. You remember, Stevie told his editor that Ivan was divorced by his wife, Agatha, 20 years ago, and how the events that followed turned the sculptor into the tired old bum he was when he slit his throat under the Brooklyn Bridge.
Well, Stevie, did Agatha get her divorce?
Yes, and the court gave her custody of their 6-year-old kid, Horace.
Hmm.
She married Greg Stevens, and according to these clippings, she kept her agreement with Thorne. She posed for the head he was doing of her so that he could finish it.
The first day of each month for 6 months, huh?
Yeah.
Hmm. How'd he take the divorce and losing his kid and all?
Beautifully, so everybody thought. It got to be the talk of the town. The three of them, Agatha, Greg, and Ivan, seemed to get along fine together. The Stevenses were frequent callers at Thorne's studio.
Oh, I say, Thorne, why won't you show me the head you're making of Agatha? It isn't fair, you know.
Not till it's finished, Greg. You wouldn't appreciate it as it is now.
It really is good, Ivan. When will you finish it?
Yes, Ivan, when?
I want to finish it on New Year's Day. That will be the last time you need pose, Agatha. Can you make it that day?
Well, I'll just have to, won't I?
Yes. At 3 o'clock?
At 3 o'clock. Come on, Greg, darling.
Good night, Ivan.
Good night, Ivan. My goodness, 6 months goes by so fast, doesn't it?
I gave them 6 months. One day it's over. One day is the last day she poses for me. One day I'll finish that head. I love her. And for 6 months, 6 centuries, she belonged to that idiot. He took my son from me. You can't hear me, Agatha. Can you? This is you and Clay. You can't hear me. Everybody thinks it's wonderful that Ivan Thorne is such a good sport about it. I fooled them all. I fooled you. Yes.
He really was out of his mind, Stevie, the Ivan guy.
Sure, but with a madman's cunning, he disguised it well at that point. Only his cats knew it, I guess. New Year's Day, 1924, was a howling wintry day. Neighbors later testified to seeing Ivan's massive frame, coat flailing open in the wind, eyes staring, unblinking, as he turned into his building. It was the last time they saw him. In his studio, Ivan kicked his door shut and began talking to Agatha's statue, as he'd gotten into the habit of doing now for some time.
I'll set the table by the fire, Agatha, just as we always did. You like that. And I'll set a place for little Horace. Oh, I know you don't want him to come here, but we'll just make believe, huh?
Agatha, I must pull myself together.
Happy New Year, Agatha. Come in, come in.
And the same to you, Ivan. Oh, let me get to that fire quickly. I'm frozen up. Why are you bolting the door?
The draft rattles the door. Here, give me a coat. Now, how about a bite? By the fire?
Why, Ivan. How quaint. Just like old times, hmm?
This is the last time you'll come to pose. Have you minded living up to our agreement?
No, Ivan. You've been very decent about it. But tell me, why are you so set on finishing the head you're doing of me?
Have you ever seen a human skull, Agatha? Ugly thing. Long after that pretty head of yours becomes a skull, the head I'm making of you will live an ageless bronze. That's why I'm so anxious to finish this work.
I see. Well, shall we start, Ivan?
You're not working. You're just staring at me.
I'm studying the line of your neck, darling. It eludes me.
Well, hurry, please. I've sat here for 2 hours now. I'm tired.
I'll be finished soon. Then you can rest, darling. Then you can rest.
Ivan, you're looking at me as though... Ivan!
You've moved your head again, darling. Here, let me show you. There. So. Just like this. Don't move, Agatha. My fingers are loose on your throat. But in a split second, I can sink them into you tight. Like this.
Don't.
I've loved you more in these few months.
You've been away from me than I ever did before.
I'll always love you. But if I can't have you, no one else can.
Ivan, you're mad. You can't.
I gave you 6 months with that fool because I wasn't sure. I thought I could get over losing you and the boy. But I can't.
We all thought you were...
resigned.
No.
Even now, I don't know if I want to kill you, Agatha. I'm not sure.
No. No, you don't. You know you don't. Think of her. Your son.
I am thinking of your little fool.
Oh, Greg. Greg, help me.
Greg. Greg. You've got the nerve to speak his name here. No. 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 You aren't Greg. Agatha, I did it. But you made me do it. How beautiful you are. Dead. Look at this clay head. Agatha, see, I was wrong. You're much more beautiful. I've changed my mind. I don't want fame. I don't want a statue. I want you. See, Agatha, I've broken it, smashed it. Greg Stevens, you should die. He did all this to us. I'll go see Greg. That's it. But I must be careful now. I must make Greg suffer. Oh. I have it. Yes. He must know that he too has lost Agatha.
That's some yarn, Stevie. He actually strangled Agatha, huh? What happened then?
He left his studio and called at the Stevens' house a little after 6. Greg Stevens and young Horace were the only ones there, except for the butler. He testified that Ivan quietly asked to see Stevens alone. He had a bundle in his arms, covered with a piece of black velvet, when Gregory greeted him.
Ivan, well, glad to see you and Happy New Year to you. But where's Agatha? She was supposed to be with you.
She'll turn up shortly. Said something about a girlfriend she had to stop by for.
Oh, I see. Well, come on in, Ivan. We can have a glass of sherry while we wait.
Thanks.
Put your package down somewhere on the table here.
Thank you.
Did you get a lot done today on the head, I mean?
Yes. I've finished it.
Oh, good. Say, that wouldn't be it in that box, would it?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it is.
Well, good heavens, man, let me see it. I've been kept from all this long enough. Now that it's finished,
Till Agatha gets here. I'm going away for a while, Stevens. Before I go, I want you to tell me something. Do you love Agatha? A lot, I mean.
A lot?
I worship her. I adore her. You know what you did to me when you took Agatha and my boy from me?
Well, the choice was hers. I'm glad for my sake. I'm sorry for you. But I thought you were resigned by now.
Resigned? You poor fool. I've lived a life of raging hate for you.
Ivan, sit down.
You don't have to be sorry for me anymore, Greg. You can start feeling sorry for yourself.
Thorn, what are you driving at?
Everything comes out even, Greg. Come over here.
What's in that box?
Come closer, Greg. Here, I'll take the cloth off. See for yourself.
Agatha. You fiend. You beast, I'll kill you.
Hurts, doesn't it, Greg? Hurts to lose, Agatha. Doesn't it?
I'll kill you. I'll kill you.
Oh, no. Get away from me. You won't kill me. I won't kill you. We'll both live to remember.
Thorne didn't kill Stevens?
No, G.C. He knocked him out. They found his footprints in the snow along with the kids. He must have stopped to say goodbye.
What a story. He slit his throat this morning as a bum on a barge.
Yeah, took his cats with him. The clay fragments I found in that box on the barge were all that was left of the clay head of Agatha.
Nobody even found out how he got away or managed to stay hidden for 20 years?
No, that's his secret.
Well, write it up, stupid.
I can't. I won't, G.C. You can't print that story.
The devil I can't. Where's this Greg Stevens? Where's Horace, the kid? Find him.
Greg Stevens died penniless and insane a year later. His kid was raised in an orphan asylum.
Well, find the kid. Now, let's see. He'd be about 26 today. Maybe he doesn't know any of these things. What a scoop. Get busy.
Look, you can't print this story. Why do you think I didn't write it up and hand it in? I feel sorry for the kid. I was raised in an asylum.
A story's a story.
What do I have to do? Draw you a diagram, G.C.? Why do you call me Stevie?
Well, because your name is Stevens, I guess. And, good heavens. You don't mean...
Yes, my name is Stevens. I never use my first name. I don't like it. It's Horace.
That's right. You're Horace Stevens.
Yes. My father was Ivan Thorne.
Have a little sculptor in your home, Better take his modeling away from him. Might grow up to be a bust. That's enough to give anybody the creeps.
It certainly is, Mr. Raymond.
Mary Bennett. Say, didn't you like our story tonight?
Well, it was exciting, all right, but why don't you tell stories about normal, happy people? Of course, folks like that never get murdered or anything, but interesting things happen to them. Nice things, too.
Like discovering Lipton's noodle soup, huh, Mary?
Well, why not? Lipton's noodle soup is a good way to brighten up a meal, and good meals are a mighty important part of life. So, folks, maybe you've tried other envelope soups, but if you've never tried Lipton's noodle soup, you've got something real nice ahead of you, because Lipton's is the favorite noodle soup of them all.
Our moral for tonight is don't drive alone. If you have a car, lucky you, form a carpool. Then, if you should have a flat tire, you'll be among friends on that cold, cold highway. Fun, huh? And Uncle Sam says join a carpool, too. He's not kidding. He says your carpool will help save gas and tires, so look to it, Max. Yes, the, this month's Inner Sanctum mystery novel is Net of Cobwebs by Elizabeth Sanksay Holding. Oh, yes, and you won't forget to look for Lee Bowman with Rita Hayworth in the Columbia Technicolor picture tonight and every night. Well, now it's time to say goodnight until next week at the same time when Lipton Tea and Lipton Soup again present another Inner Sanctum mystery. Directed by Hyman Brown. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
Folks, I got to thinking about wintertime, about snowmen and frost pictures on the windows, and about how cozy a house can be when there's a gale blowing outside. And then I got to thinking about Lipton tea. Because a cup of Lipton's, the tea with that brisk flavor, really hits the spot. It's so cheerful and warming. You know, the word brisk, B-R-I-S-K, means that Lipton tea has a fresh, lively flavor. It's never thin or wishy-washy. That's why Lipton's is America's favorite tea. So don't forget to ask for it when you go to the grocery store. And don't forget to tune in next Tuesday night for another Inner Sanctum Mystery. ¶¶
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Do you know how old the school building in your community is? If it's over 25 years old, the chances are that it's woefully inadequate. Join with the groups in your community working for better school conditions. Remember, better schools build a stronger America.
Now I have, for your approval, an episode of Alien Worlds, which was an American syndicated radio show of a rather short run. It only produced 26 episodes in 1979, beginning on January the 7th. I kind of like it, though. It has an excellent soundtrack and high production standards, and was reasonably successful, really, despite its short run. It played on over 500 radio stations all over the country, and would be even more successful after it was picked up in New Zealand and Australia. These stories involve the governing body for development and exploration of space, called the ISA, which is short for International Space Authority. It's an international organization whose job is to advance the interests of humans out among the stars. The base is officially named the Arthur C. Clarke Astronomical Observatory, but is generally in the series referred to as Star Lab. Oh, and there's a computer named Mycroft. Today, the episode from July the 28th of 1979, the story involves a time machine on the planet Valeria, to which members of Star Lab are invited to observe. What could go wrong? You know, what could go wrong? Plenty.
Slowly rotating at the edge of deep space, 1,000 kilometers beyond the atmosphere of 21st century Earth, is the Arthur C. Clarke Astronomical Observatory, Star Lab. Here, Starlab Research Director Maura Cassidy, along with scientists and technicians of the International Space Authority, watch over the countless suns, planets, and star systems that fill the universe. This week, space exploration team captains John Graydon and Buddy Griff experience the dislocating shock of time clash and discover how suddenly the here and now can be transformed into the now and then on Alien Worlds.
Correct your approach vector, Captain. You're 19 degrees off course.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Don't just see what you can do, Captain. Make a decision. You're running out of time.
What's going on, Jerry?
We've got a problem, Maura. If that petroleum tanker on screen 6 doesn't correct its approach vector, it won't clear the docking bay.
How's that, Starlab? Any better?
Pandora, you're still 14 degrees off course. Abort your approach. Return to your original position and stand by for new docking coordinates.
Roger.
Why are you guiding him in, Jerry? Is there something wrong with your navigational computer?
It blew a decoder module 5 minutes into the approach. And that guy is the worst pilot I've ever...
There's no way we can abort our approach, Starlab. We've got a retro malfunction.
Hit the collision alert, Maura.
This is an emergency alert. All personnel, please clear the area. Repeat, clear the area. Docking Officer Clark, contact the bridge.
Jerry, it's Bill Clark.
Any chance he might make it?
Not unless you believe in miracles.
Okay, Bill, get
right, Commissioner. The Pandora's guidance computer and retro system hadn't been serviced in over 2 years. And the crew couldn't get out because the explosive bolts on the emergency hatch malfunctioned. If our EFC crew hadn't put out the fire so fast, everyone aboard the Pandora would have burned alive.
Commissioner, when is the Xeon Corporation going to forget about petroleum and wake up to the fact that this is the 21st century?
They can't afford to wake up, Mara. The 20th century petroleum investments still account for 60% of their assets.
The only way they can make a profit on that petroleum is by selling it on Stella Vista.
But Xeon owns Stella Vista. What are they doing, selling it to themselves?
No, they're selling it to the independent mining companies out there.
Xeon has it all figured out, Mara. If a company wants to lease mineral rights on Stella Vista, they can do it. But only if they agree to use obsolete fossil fuel equipment. This way, Xeon not only makes money on their mineral leases, but they have a captive market for their petroleum.
Well, if that isn't extortion, I don't know what is.
Ethically, it is extortion, Mara. Legally, it's known as taking care of business.
The good news is that Xeon will have to keep its tanker fleet grounded until we finish our investigation of what happened today. Don't worry. Xeon won't be putting up any more tankers like the Pandora.
Do you know about the original Pandora, Commissioner?
The one in Greek mythology?
Well, my Greek mythology is a little rusty. But I believe Pandora was sent to Earth to punish mankind. I don't remember why. But I do remember she had some kind of magic box.
The Fire of Heaven, Commissioner. She was sent to punish mankind for accepting the Fire of Heaven from Prometheus. And when she opened that box, she released an eternity of human suffering. You know, I thought about that today when the Pandora split open in the docking bay. What happened was so ugly and terrifying. For a split second, I saw everything mankind had suffered during the last century. All because the oil of the earth, like the fire of heaven, had been used to make people small instead of great.
18 hours after the oil tanker Pandora has split open and exploded in docking bay 7, an ISA disaster investigation team and a Xeon Corporation space tug arrive at Starlab from Earth. 10 hours later, the crew of the Pandora is taken to the nearby Stargazer security station for interrogation. And as the Xeon Corporation tug prepares to tow the burned-out hull of the Pandora back to Earth, Starlab scientists, technicians, and space exploration team officers begin a new day.
Skipper, when we get to Valaria this afternoon, let's ask their science master, what's his name again?
Galen Virago.
Yeah. Let's ask Galen Virago if we can go for a spin in that time machine of his.
Oh, I don't think so, buddy.
Where would you go if you could take a ride in it? I'd like to go back to 1939 and have Lamont Cranston teach me how to cloud men's minds.
Lamont Cranston?
Yeah, the Shadow. He knew what evil lurked in the hearts of men.
And how did he know that?
When he clouded their minds, they told him the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I see. And what exactly would you do if you had the power to cloud men's minds?
I'd use it to cloud women's minds.
Sexist pill.
Coin, 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 coin.
Morning, Captain Graydon. Captain Griff.
Yeah, good morning, Cindy.
Cindy, have you had your mind clouded lately?
No, not since I read Six Characters in Search of an Author.
What's that, Cindy, a novel?
It's a play, Luigi Pirandello, 1921. The characters in the play are rehearsing the play when six other people show up, claiming to be characters the author left out of the play when he wrote it.
Were any of the people who showed up named Lamont Cranston by any chance?
No, Captain, not even by any chance. Now, how about breakfast? You ready to order?
Can you give us a few more minutes, Cindy? We're waiting for Dr. Cassidy and Commissioner White.
Okay.
Gee, I wonder what's keeping Mara.
I don't know. Maybe Commissioner White's shuttle was late.
Yeah, that tanker accident was really... Oh, here she comes now.
Morning, John. Buddy.
Hello, Mara.
Hi. Where's Commissioner White?
He spent most of the night with the ISA Legal Bureau, drafting the order to ground Xeon's tanker fleet. He's going to deliver it this afternoon, so he suggested we go on to Valaria without him.
Well, does that mean he's going to miss the time machine demonstration?
Just the parallel dimension drone pod playback, which I'm sure Galen will be happy to repeat.
The commissioner said he'd be here tomorrow morning around 10, so when he arrives, you two can warp back here in the Solaris, pick him up, and warp back to Valaria again, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Let me see that menu, buddy. I'm starving.
Here you go.
Thank you. Ooh. Ooh, those Neo cheese crepes look delicious, don't they?
Cheese.
Mm.
You know, that reminds me of a story.
Oh, dear.
There was this guy who had a mouse in his house. So he went out and bought a mousetrap. But when he got it home, he noticed he was out of cheese. You know what he used for bait?
Mm.
A picture of some cheese. And you know what he found in the trap the next morning?
Do tell.
A picture of a mouse.
Buddy.
Meanwhile, on Valaria, science master Galen Virago and his apprentice Marika Zarnos enter the chronology pavilion of Valaria's Magnitude 5 research complex. Standing in the center of the pavilion, illuminated by the cool white light of 200 free-floating microlamps, is the experimental time machine, a large 20-sided chamber made of semi-opaque metal. Suspended above the chamber is the penetrator capsule, a teardrop-shaped pod made of bright, seamless metal, which Galen and Marika have used to record fragments of the Earth's past.
Marika, I want to conduct one last test before Dr. Cassidy arrives. Lower the pod into the chamber. Are the chamber seals secure?
Yes, Galen. The REM scale indicators read 0 point blue.
Rotate the chamber until its decoders interlock with the pod's Yerushalayim data.
Yerushalayim interlock confirmed.
Interface the decoder lenses with day 12, month 4, AD 33, Earth.
Decoder lenses stable at subcycle 9 point yellow.
Focus them on the subspan 303 and isolate the dimension.
Dimensional isolation confirmed. I have the execution site on the screen.
Is the deciphering terminal translating into Anglophonic?
Yes.
Cross-link the audio sensors.
Double vision from the warp through.
Oh, so do we, Mora.
Terrific.
So, here we are. Six characters in search of Valaria. Oh, speaking of Valaria, there it is. Screen 9, Skip.
Solaris to Valaria Com Center.
We're tracking you, Solaris. Reduce speed to 1,200 kilometers per hour and maintain present course for 3 minutes, 16 seconds. At 0 plus 316, terminate your engines and lock your controls. One of our pilot drones will guide you down.
Roger. I'll take it down to 1,200 kph, buddy.
First got here. You know, I really don't think I could have made it through the day. They all just stood there and watched him die.
Someday you must tell me about that holy man and why he was submitted to such torture and pain.
We will, Galen.
May I be permitted to say something about the three of you? Of course. The way you've reacted to the tragic events of your planet's past leads me to believe that if the Earth had always been inhabited by spirits like yours, much of what we've seen here today would never have happened.
As Valaria's twin suns tint the morning sky a pale, crystalline yellow, the Valarian Comm Center receives a transmission from Starlab.
Please inform Dr. Cassidy that Commissioner White has arrived, and that you'll meet Captain Brayden and Captain Griff in docking Bay 31.
Half an hour later, Buddy and John board the Solaris, and as Mara and Galen watch from the Valaria Tracking Center, the sleek, white SET interceptor blasts off for Starlab.
We're ready to warp through, Mara. Can you still see us?
Affirmative, John. The resolution on this screen is so good, I can practically see into the cockpit.
How many fingers am I holding up, Mara?
13?
She really can see into the cockpit. All right, here we go. Warp through in 5 seconds. Mara, it's all turning inside out. Mara!
John! Buddy! Galen, what's happening?
Just a moment. Just a moment. The Parsec device. The Parsec device aboard the Solaris has experienced a primary decoder malfunction. The ship is passing through the time-space continuum in reverse.
Galen, the ship's back on the screen. John, Buddy, do you read me?
Yes, Ma. I read you.
John?
Ma, help us. We become children.
Master Galen Virago immediately orders the launch of a pilot drone, which locks onto the Solaris and returns it to Valaria. Two hours later, Buddy and John are once again standing before the Valarian time chamber.
Well, Buddy, looks like you're gonna get that right after all.
Yeah. You will be joining me, of course.
Naturally. It isn't every day that we get a chance to ride the Whirlwind.
The Whirlwind?
It's part of a verse by an 18th century English writer named Joseph Addison. My mother used to read his poems to me.
How does the rest of the verse go?
Let me see. And please the Almighty's orders to perform. Rides in the whirlwind and directs the storm. Kind of sums up our situation, doesn't it?
It sure does.
Galen, are you absolutely certain there's no danger?
They won't be harmed, Mara. Marika has transported me into Valaria's past many times.
You didn't indicate that in the communique you sent to Commissioner White.
I didn't indicate it in the communiques I transmitted to the other planets either.
Why not?
Marika?
This is our third machine, Mara, and during its construction, we decided that the secrets of time travel would be shared only with those who understand that all life is sacred, and that all living things, no matter how small, have an infinity of their own that must be respected.
Those who do not understand that are the ones who will use time travel to dangerously manipulate not only their own destinies, but the destinies of others.
If during yesterday's drone pod demonstration, you and Buddy and John had reacted indifferently to the tragic events of your planet's past, we would have sent you away this morning.
And if, as you went away, this accident had transformed all three of you, we would have simply closed our eyes and put you out of our minds.
Then you were testing us.
Time is a fragile thing, Mara. And its control can be permitted to exist only where fragile things are loved.
Well, Mar, it looks like we've passed the test of time after all.
Do you both still feel the same? I mean, you're not frightened or anything like that.
Nothing's changed, Mara. It's like Galen said earlier. The physical organism changes during time reversal, but consciousness doesn't. It feels good to be alive inside a child's body. We're not young, we're not old, and we're not afraid.
The chamber is ready, Galen. I've interfaced their time, date, and place of birth information with the alternate reality decoders, and the dimensional inversion lenses are stable at subcycle 6. Violet.
Buddy, John, go into the chamber now. Cross-link the audio sensors, Marika.
John, buddy, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Do you want us to lie down on these recliners, Marika?
Yes.
Now, close your eyes and relax. During the reversal, you will both be transported back to the separate moments of your birth, and then return to the here and now. You will be unconscious when you return, and you will have no memory of what happened to you aboard the Solaris.
Okay, Galen. See you later, Mara. Goodbye. See you soon.
Begin the cycle, Marika.
Its control can be permitted to exist only where fragile things are not.
Time is an illusion. We're not passing through it. It's passing through us.
I'm physical. I am dying. I am divine. Shall we return to the sea without you?
Four in the afternoon. Have I been asleep all this time?
More or less.
Well, where's John? What about Commissioner White?
John just woke up, too. And Commissioner White decided to take his own ship. He'll be here in about half an hour. How do you feel?
Like Rip Van Winkle must have felt when he woke up. Spaced out and hungry enough to eat a kangaroo. Well, that's funny.
What?
What's the date today, Maura?
November 14th. Why?
Well, the calendar on my watch. I just noticed it. It says May 23rd. My birthday.
Time Clash was written by Ron Thompson and starred Linda Gary, Chuck Olson, Bruce Philip Miller, and Corey Burton. With special guest stars Mel Wells, Eric Taslitz, Susan Silo, and Eric Green. Associate producer Ron Thompson. Music director Tom Rounds. Engineer Stu Jacobs. Assistant to the producer Jim Cook. Technical consultant Peter Skye. Alien Worlds was created, produced, and directed by Lee Hansen and is distributed by Watermark Incorporated. And so until next week, this is Roger Dressler inviting you to join us for our next adventure from the elsewhere and elsewhen of Alien Worlds.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joy Chan. English Fairy Tales collected by Joseph Jacobs. The Golden Arm. He was once a man who travelled the land all over in search of a wife. He saw young and old, rich and poor, pretty and plain, and could not meet with one to his mind. At last he found a woman, young, fair, and rich, who possessed a right arm of solid gold. He married her at once, and thought no man so fortunate as he was. They lived happily together, but, though he wished people to think otherwise, he was fonder of the golden arm than of all his wife's gifts besides. At last she died. The husband put on the blackest black, and pulled the longest face at the funeral. But for all that he got up in the middle of the night, dug up the body, and cut off the golden arm. He hurried home to hide his treasure and thought no one would know. The following night he put the golden arm under his pillow, and was just falling asleep, when the ghost of his dead wife glided into the room. Stalking up to the bedside, it drew the curtain and looked at him reproachfully. Pretending not to be afraid, he spoke to the ghost and said, "What hast thou done with thy cheeks so red?" "All withered and wasted away," replied the ghost in a hollow tone. "What hast thou done with thy red rosy lips?" "All withered and wasted away." "What hast thou done with thy golden hair?" "All withered and wasted away." "What hast thou done with thy golden arm?" "Thou hast it."
Another 5-minute mystery.
You're hired to watch the stage door, not to hold up production.
Just the same, Johnny. You're holding that curtain till the cops arrive. Girl was just found murdered in the Star's dressing room.
Murder, all right. Plain, cold-blooded murder. Cruel blow in the temple. Anybody know who she is?
Why, she's one of the chorus line, Inspector. Sybil Lang.
I see. Mr. Roberts, I understand this is your dressing room.
That's right, Inspector, it is. Ghastly mess, isn't it? Mr. Roberts is Johnny Roberts, Inspector, the noted tap dancer. Being the star of the show, we gave him the big room.
And you were on stage at the time the murder was discovered, Mr. Roberts?
Well, practically. I'd been standing in the wings waiting for curtain. Pardon me, Inspector, but that crowd out there is growing impatient. As long as no one can leave, I see no reason for holding curtain. People have paid plenty to get a look at Roberts.
Well, I suppose there's no harm. The show must go on.
I say, Inspector, that's sporting of you. I'll be back in 5 minutes.
The thing that gets me... Mac here swears no one left the theater all evening.
I'd vouch for that too, Inspector. You see, as producer, it's my business to keep tab on the cast.
That means the murderer is still among us. But where, then, did he dispose of the weapon? He wouldn't have risked being caught leaving the room with it on him. We'd searched everywhere, and there isn't a sign of anything heavy enough to administer that death blow.
Why would a pretty girl like that be in a mess like this, anyway?
Mr. Roberts!
Confound these boisterous audiences! Oh, there you are, Jerry.
Well, what is it, Roberts? What's the crowd kicking up about?
Look here, Jerry. A star is entitled to some rights. I tell you, I won't have it. They're insisting, demanding I dance. Now, you promised me it. Well, it says in the contract, I MC this show. No audience is going to railroad me.
You don't mean you're going against audience will, Mr. Roberts. I thought it was the public that makes or breaks you.
Not John Roberts. I'll tear up my contract first. I'll tear it up.
That won't be necessary, Mr. Roberts. That contract is going to be broken anyway. John Roberts, I arrest you for the murder of Sybil Lang.
Why did the inspector arrest John Roberts? Do you know the clue? In just a moment, we'll hear more, but first...
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock. 9, 13, 14, 17, or... just a minute. Or to hell with it.
And now let's see what the inspector has to say.
What are you talking about? You can't arrest me. I'll sue.
Just a minute, Roberts. Why did you just refuse to dance when that audience gave you that commanding ovation? You're wearing tap shoes, so you can't say you weren't prepared.
Well, I didn't want to dance, that's why.
Oh, no, Mr. Roberts. I'll tell you why you refused. You couldn't dance. Those loaded taps you put on the tap shoes you're wearing are too heavy for nimble dancing. But they weren't too heavy to deal a death blow. You killed Sybil Lang. You might have walked away with the clue. Yes, literally walked right off with it. If that audience hadn't wanted to see John Roberts go into his act. Now I suggest you hand those shoes over as Exhibit A. You might find them a little too heavy when you walk the last mile.
Coming up is Escape, which ran on CBS from 1947 to 1954, dealing with a variety of stories, science fiction, horror. It had a fondness for adventure tales set in the tropics or on the high seas. And as far as I have been able to find out, there are a total of 194 stories. A lot of the stories are taken from classic stories, but not all. Often the writers and producers of Escape culled material from stories that were not then considered classic, but in some cases have gained that status since. Not that the radio show really had anything to do with it. This distinction was brought about by the excellence of the material itself and the garnishment of time. Today's episode is not based on a classic, but it was written by the staff writer and producer, Anthony Ellis, and is called A Study in Wax. It takes place in an isolated cabin in the northern Canadian wilderness. It's a story that's set at Christmas time, but it's not a Christmas tale. It's a story about two men, alone in the Arctic, who must endure each other's company for 7 months. It opens in late October, and the men have been left behind to work on a Canadian geodetic survey, and they're on their own until spring. This is made worse by the loss of the radio transmitter. With no connection to the outside, one of them slowly turns mad. As you can figure out, this can't be good. This episode aired on February the 1st of 1953.
Tired of the everyday grind? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all? We offer you Escape.
Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
You are trapped in a snowbound cabin in northern Canada. The temperature is slowly dropping. While across the table from you, his eyes staring at you, is your only companion, a madman, waiting for his chance to kill you.
Listen now as Escape brings you Anthony Ellis's terrifying story, A Study in Wax.
It was late October when the radio shack burned down. We never did decide whose fault it was. Maybe Cabell with his cigarettes, or maybe me. Anyway, I guess the whole thing began when we lost the phone transmitter and receiver. Cabell and I had been sent up to the Northwest Territory by the Canadian Geodetic Survey people. It was a long job, and the biggest part of it was the loneliness. I remember what Cabell said as we watched the government supply boat steaming off.
It's going to be a long winter.
Yeah. Hope they don't run into any trouble on the way back. That ice is closing in fast.
Yeah. Nice, so long, Jules. See you next spring. It's getting cold.
It feels like snow. Probably get some tonight.
Yeah.
Well, we might as well get the rest of the stuff unpacked, huh?
All right. It's kind of lonely when I'm gone, you know?
Yeah.
I guess it's the quiet.
You better get used to it.
Oh, I will. It's funny, though, after spending most of your life in cities, I suppose you feel this kind of thing more. There's an awful lot of nothing out there.
You need a drink. Come on. It wasn't that Cabell was moody or anything like that. I think he wasn't used to being out of touch with people and things he was accustomed to in the cities. I was the opposite. I kind of liked the loneliness. As a matter of fact, now that I think about it, we were a pretty strange couple to hit it off the way we did. And when you got 7 months to spend alone with another man, you got to be sure of each other. And we thought we were. Until after the radio was gone. That day it burned, we stood in the snow watching the embers glowing and wisps of smoke rising into the cold sky.
Well, it's gone.
Well, we still got the code center, just in case.
Yeah, I know, but I'm going to miss the programs and the music.
Now, I tell you, we could send a message to the base, if you like, ask him to fly out another.
Oh, no, 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 no. You know, McLeod, he'd boil. Waste of money, probably take it out of our pay. No, we'll do without it.
That's all right with me.
You're a hardy soul. I don't think you'd mind if you had to stay here alone for 7 months, you know?
Be dull. I wouldn't have anybody to beat at chess. Well, I think we better use the theodolites tomorrow. Get to work on that western section over the range.
Uh-huh.
Triangulation, huh?
Oh, Jack.
Yeah, what?
If it was my cigarette that burned down the shack, I'm sorry.
Forget it. I may have done it myself. Forget it. By the end of November, we'd done pretty well as far as work was concerned. But Cabell was getting jittery. We had a weak stretch where we couldn't move out of the camp. It was around 30 below outside and blowing 60 miles an hour. Cabell had read most of the things we'd brought along and was sitting at the table trying to beat a solitaire game. I was oiling my gun. Odds are against you every time.
Oh, I know it. Oh, I wish this weather would ease off.
It will.
Hey, I got an idea.
What?
What do you say we open our Christmas presents tonight?
Our Christmas?
Yeah.
It's November.
I know, but I'll bet there'll be some books. I told my folks to pack some books.
Yeah, well, what'll you do when you're finished?
I don't know, but I've got to do something. I just wish we had the radio.
Look, we can send a message. If McLeod wants to cut our heads off for burning up his property, he'll have to come here to do it. If not, maybe he'll be feeling good and send it to us.
Well, it's worth a try. Do you mind? It's not you, Jack. We talk and play chess, and it's swell, but I miss the outside. I feel like...
Oh. I know. Give me a pencil.
Sure, I'll get it. Here you
are. Thanks. Yeah, how does this sound? Radio Shack burned to ground. Can you send new receiver?
Mm-hmm.
Have only small set on fixed channel.
Jack, couldn't you say emergency?
No, that'd go over big with McLeod. We miss Canadian and U.S. mystery shows. Must continue to hear them in order to keep up our work. Leave it as it is. Switch on the generator, will you?
Sure.
It's kind of stuffy in here, isn't it?
I was thinking it was cold.
Old woman. Well, here we go. McLeod's going to love this. The reply from McLeod came back the following day. It was long, involved, and set what could have been said in one word. No. Our chief was a very careful man and believed in others following his example. Therefore, if our radio was gone, it was our fault, and the next time we should be more careful. And that was that. The weather let up a bit, and we got some work done. It was still terribly cold, but it didn't bother us now that the wind was gone. I noticed that Cabell was much quieter after our request for the radio had been turned down. I began to get a feeling as though he blamed me for it. So, a week before Christmas, we just finished supper, and I said, Larry, about those Christmas presents,
What about them?
What do you say we open them, huh?
Why, I thought you didn't want to until Christmas.
Well, I gotta change my mind.
No? What's the matter? You're trying to be nice to me? I can take this as well as you can, you know. I don't need you feeling sorry for
me. Oh, I'm not sorry. I don't give a good stink one way or the other. I'm just saying if you want to open the packages now, it's all right with me. They're yours. It's not my business. Now, forget it. Do what you want.
Oh, wait. Will you open yours?
Sure.
Okay.
He got a hammer and started to pry open the case. Our families and friends had done their shopping in August, and we'd put their gifts together in the case. And at the sight of those colorful wrappings, Cabell began to smile.
Oh, mother of mine.
He was back in touch again. There were little things, but a label, a scratch of handwriting, the feel of something different was blotting out his loneliness.
Hey, we did great.
The great far coldness outside.
Come on over. Come on. See what you got.
Okay.
It doesn't feel like books. They wouldn't crack them like this, would they?
No, they might.
This is from my sister. You met her, Jack. Nancy, the one in Winnipeg.
Oh, Nancy. Oh, yeah, sure.
Hey, look.
Huh?
Look at that. Look what we got. It's a phonograph.
A phonograph?
Yeah, there must be some records in here. Jack, wind it up, will you?
Oh, yeah.
This is great. There's a big stack up here. There must be... Oh, of all the lousy, crummy luck.
What? What's the matter?
They're broken.
Oh, that's a shame.
Broken.
All of them?
Well, there's... Wait a minute. There's two of them. It's okay.
Well, that's good.
Great. Listen to this, will you?
What?
Bugle calls of His Majesty's Army.
What?
I mean it. Look. It belonged to my father. I remember him playing when I was a kid.
Oh, what's the other one?
Let's see. Oh, it's The Age of Gold, Shostakovich. It's one of my favorites.
No Benny Goodman or anything like that, huh?
No. That's right. I forgot you. You don't much like this long hair music, do you?
Oh, not much. It's okay. Come on, let's take a listen to that bugle call thing. That ought to be something. Here, I think I got to wind up enough.
Wait till I tell Nancy about that fancy packing job I heard.
The following bugle sounds are the authorized calls to be used in His Majesty's service. The charge.
The charge. Oh, this brings back memories.
The alarm.
You know, we could have used this one when the shack burned down.
Officers call.
No. Oh. On this one, everybody comes. No, it's the next one. Yeah, but...
We got a lot of laughs out of that old record. Played it a couple of times and had a couple of drinks. And I tell you, that phonograph, even with only two records, it made a lot of difference to us. The strain seemed to be gone. And then Cabell put on his Shostakovich and got lost in it. To me, it wasn't much. It was all cluttered up with a lot of noise that hurt your ears. Well, he must have played it a half a dozen times while we unwrapped the rest of the things. There were a lot of books and magazines, and that was real good. I figured we could stretch him out for at least 3 months, which would take us into March. But by the next day, the weather turned bad. A blizzard came down. We stayed inside until the day after Christmas. And Cabell, he was like a kid. He smoked cigars, drank brandy, listened to his record, and read. In 10 days, he'd read every single thing. And then he had nothing to do but listen to his record.
Thank you.
Oh, you're not going to play it again.
Sure, you mind?
Well, I wouldn't mind not listening to it for a while. Why don't you try the bugle calls? They're quieter anyway.
Learn to appreciate good music, Jack. You're missing something.
Well, maybe I will. But not from that.
It's beautiful.
Well, not to me it isn't. Why don't you let it go for a while, huh?
All right. Feel that way, bud. How about a game?
No, not right now, thanks. I want to finish reading this article.
What are you reading? Oh, yeah, I read that. That's not much. You know, that guy never could write.
Oh? I think it's pretty good.
Depends on what you're used to reading, I guess.
What kind of a crack is that?
Nothing. Nothing. It just depends on what you're used to reading, that's all.
Does that make me a lowbrow?
No, you said it. I didn't.
You better check the oil outside.
I did it yesterday. It's your turn.
I did it this morning. In this weather, we do it twice a day. You remember?
Oh, yes, sir.
You trying to be funny?
No, I just didn't like the way you said it. We're both in charge here, you know. Not you or me. Nobody gives orders here. We share the responsibility.
Okay, then do your share.
All right. I'm going out to check the oil, and not because you say to do it, you know, but because I want to.
Well, good for you. When I think of it now, we sounded like a couple of kids. And I can't even remember what it was that set us off. But I'll never forget what happened because of that day. Yeah. Don't easily forget a thing like death.
Cabell and I didn't talk to each other for the next few days. Not the way we used to, I mean. Just conversation that was necessary to do our work. And that was it. He didn't play his record either. New Year's Eve day, we got a couple of messages through in code from our families. And I guess we both felt pretty bad. Cabell was trimming the oil stove when I decided to try and make things up. Say, Larry.
Yeah?
Look about that business the other night. I'm sorry.
It's my fault. Really, it's kind of silly, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's probably just as well that we had the bust up then. There's still 3 months to go before that ship comes back.
Yeah, I know. And thanks for not playing that record.
It's okay. Oh, I wish the thing would stop. It gets on my nerves.
You know something? I got something that's good for that.
What? What do you got there?
Something to toast the new year.
Champagne?
Yeah.
And two bottles. Oh, what an idea. What a jacket. This is wonderful.
We'll stick them outside for a couple of minutes and cool them.
Well, here, let me have them. I'll do it.
Okay.
Oh, we're going to cut you in two. Oh, that's cold. You want to know something? The best thing for you and me to do tonight is to get roaring, stinking drunk.
Champagne with brandy chasers.
Right.
Happy New Year, Larry.
Same to you, Jack.
And we got drunk. We got red-eyed drunk. And we talked about women and ourselves and our dreams. And it was sloppy and it was great. The kind of a haze you get when it doesn't matter and you're feeling good about everything. And it was fine. Until Cabell decided it was time to hear some music.
Jack, I want you to really listen to this now. Really listen. This Shostakovich, he makes them all look sick with this thing. Now, I want you to really listen.
I know. I don't want to hear that thing. Don't.
No.
I don't
want to
hear it.
Give it a chance. Just listen.
But I don't like it, Larry.
Well, now, listen. I'm going to explain it. Listen to what he does with a ribbon. That's great music, friend. That's really great.
That's not music. It's a lot of noise. It's a noise.
Just shut up, will you? You're not listening.
Don't tell me to shut up.
You know, you just don't understand good music. That's the matter with you.
I understand it, but I don't want to listen to it.
Well, I want to hear it. Jack, don't take that off.
Take your hands off of me or you're going to get hurt.
Now, listen, Jack, you stay away from that machine.
Get out of my way.
Get it off. Get pushy from you. I'm going to kick your brains out for that.
I'm sick of you and your filthy music and everything.
Well, cut that racket.
Now, take a good listen. Because you're not going to hear it anymore, this thing. Not as long as I'm here.
Put it down, Jack. I mean it. Put it down. Put it down or I'll shoot you. I'll do it if you don't put that record down.
And I got sober. I might never have had a drink. I was so sober. Cabell had reached up for one of the holsters that hung near the door. And he wobbled to his feet. A gun held tightly in his hand. There was blood running out of his mouth and down his chin. And I just stood there. And I put the record down on the turntable.
You were gonna break it, weren't you?
Yeah.
I knew you were. I knew because it gives me pleasure to listen to it, and you don't like that. Well, listen, I want to listen to it, and you don't, so you get outside.
Oh, Larry, you...
Go on! I'll kill you if you don't. Now get outside.
Larry, you're crazy. It's 40 below out there. I'll freeze.
That'll do you real good. Now you go on, Jack. You get outside.
All right, but let me get my things.
No!
Larry, listen to me. You're drunk. You don't know what you're doing.
You open that door. Open it! Now go on out!
I thought I heard the music again. He was crazy. Crazy drunk. I went around to the back trying to get away from the wind, but it wasn't any good. There wasn't anywhere to get away from it. I've seen what happened to men caught in the open this way, and I knew how quickly it could happen. So I ran and I jumped. Anything to keep moving. And all the time, I couldn't believe it was happening. I don't know how much time went by. Maybe it was a minute. Maybe it was 10.
Jack! Jack, where are you? Jack!
I heard him calling. Through the flurries of powdered snow blown off the roof, I saw Cabell standing in the doorway. And I saw the gun still in his hand, hanging by his side.
Come on in, Jack!
And I forgot the cold.
Jack!
I only knew that Cabell had gone mad and he was going to kill me. Somehow I had to get him away from the cabin, get him outside where I'd have a chance. I waited for a minute, and then... Larry! Larry, over here, Larry!
Jack!
Over here! I knew that he'd heard me.
Jack!
And I saw him move out from the doorway.
Larry, can you hear me? Where are you?
Over here, over this way! And I moved back behind a hummock. I thought I might be able to make a wide circle and double back to the cabin before he knew what was happening.
Jack! I couldn't hear you, Larry! Jack, where are you?
Larry! Larry! And the wind burned my eyes so that I couldn't see, and I tripped and I fell. My hands, bare, didn't feel the coldness of snow any longer.
Jack! Jack, over here! Jack!
He must have seen me. He was close enough. Close enough to shoot. And I tried to run,
stumbling, falling. And what better was easier when I was going downhill? But he was behind me.
Jack, come back, sir! Jack, it's all right, come back!
And then there was something different in the feel of the ground under me. It wasn't ground anymore. Not snow. It was ice.
Jack!
I reached the shore and I was going out on the frozen sea.
Jack, don't go out there!
And I began to imagine that I could feel the movement of the sea under me. And suddenly it didn't matter anymore. I didn't care. I couldn't run. I just wanted to lie down.
Jack!
I just wanted to lie down.
Jack, take it easy. It's all right. It's going to be all right. You don't have to be afraid. Jack, you can have the gun if you want.
I was no more than 8 feet away from him. I just lay there watching, waiting for him to shoot. And the dark ribbon that split the ice grew wider. A semicircle of ice had cracked away. It wasn't very big, and it was drifting out away. Away. And the ribbon was no longer a ribbon. And in that moment, I knew that he hadn't wanted to kill me. That I'd been wrong. Larry! Larry, jump in! Swim! Now, come on, swim! You can make it!
I can't!
Come on, Larry, swim!
I can't swim! I can't swim, Jack!
Well, try to! You gotta try! Please, hurry, Larry! They moved away faster after that. Then I couldn't see him anymore. He was lost in the blackness. But I could hear him. Oh, Lord, I could hear him. I got back to the cabin. And I remember getting the transmitter switched on, sending a message through. Then I got a flashlight and my furs on. I don't know how long I was down there on the ice, shouting, looking. But I knew he was gone. I'd never see him again. And in the gray morning, the planes came, and for 2 days they searched until the weather forced them back. And that was all. They flew me back to the hospital. Maybe I'll lose my hands, maybe not. Not sure yet. Well, it doesn't matter anyway.
Well, okay, that's it. That's another Night Transmissions in the can. Well, almost in the can. Oh, and before I go, I'm going to give you my email address in hopes that somebody will write me. If you're so disposed, I'm available at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You can also drop by the website. There's a contact button there. Oh, well, the website, as you might expect, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Whenever you're dealing with anything on the internet and night transmissions, www.nighttransmissions.com. There, I said it. See ya.